This week, South Africa is in the grips of a major electricity crisis. We'll look at how and where it went wrong for Africa's most industrialized nation. Is its heavy reliance on coal to blame? Are there other factors at play? As the global energy crisis deepens, should African countries accelerate their switch to renewable energy or cash in on their vast reserves of oil, gas, and other fossil fuels? Straight Talk Africa starts now. South Africa's power crisis. It forced President Cyril Ramaphosa to rush home from the funeral of Britain's Queen Elizabeth last month and skip the United Nations General Assembly. Experts say the crisis is wrecking the nation's economy and scaring off investors. At the heart of the problem is South Africa's state-owned power company, Eskom. Here's a bit of background for you on the beleaguered company. We're going to pull up a graphic here. Eskom owns the country's vast electrical grid and generates about 90% of South Africa's power. It has a constitutional mandate to guarantee electricity as a basic right. Eskom also exports electricity to other African countries, these seven: Botswana, Eswatini, Lesotho, Mozambique, Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. Nearly all of the power generated by Eskom comes from coal. South Africa is one of the world's top coal producers. The nation's coal mines employ around 95,000 people. Now, burning coal for electricity is how South Africa became the continent's industrial powerhouse. Eskom, however, has been unable to meet the growing demand for power, struggling with its aging power plants, corruption, and mismanagement. The result? Rolling power cuts, known as load shedding, that have left South African households and businesses in the dark. Tuso Khumalo has more.
Buti Mashiko is one of the people considered to be living a decent life in the densely populated suburb of Soweto in Johannesburg. But the constant power cuts being experienced across the country have extremely frustrated this respected construction entrepreneur and his family. The family has to endure 9 hours without electricity daily.
This is very serious, because right now we are sitting in the dark. I can't watch the TV, I can't watch the news, I don't know what's going on in the country now.
The meal times have been the worst affected for this family of eight. Sometimes power goes off in the middle of cooking. Eating cold food has become the new normal for this family. On a daily basis, this family has to throw away refrigerated food that has gone bad. This has increased their financial burden.
If there are any leftovers, we have to eat them cold, early in the morning, since the fridge is also affected. We do that to avoid throwing food away, because food is now very expensive.
Kiabetswe Mashiho is Buti's oldest daughter. She is preparing for her final high school exams June next month, but the power cuts are now a stumbling block.
It does affect my studies because the results of the challenges that I'm facing might lead to me failing.
The youngsters in this home also have to miss out watching their favorite cartoons. The Kengli has become their source of light as they play their evening games just before going to bed. This dark experience across the country has forced some families to turn to solar energy to escape the darkness and cold baths.
Sometimes there will be guys jumping in, trying to enter into your premises, and you can't see them. They're not visible. So we install a few solar lights.
And experts say the future is even darker unless something is done fast.
Failure or refusal by the government and the newly appointed board to remove Andre de Reiter as the CEO and Caleb Kassim as the CFO will plunge this country into a total blackout, which will be the collapse of the transmission grid within the next 3 months. That is what South Africa is facing.
The country's power utility Eskom spokesperson Sekonati Manjanja, who refused to speak on camera, told VOA that the power cuts have been as a result of South Africa's failure to build new power stations while neglecting the maintenance of existing ones. The government has failed to find solutions. President Cyril Ramaphosa, who was on a trip abroad a few weeks ago, had to urgently return home to deal with the crisis. However, nothing has changed so far. This means South Africa's road to a dark future is still long and winding. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Now, of course, South Africa is not alone in this, but what lessons can we learn from South Africa's experience? It's estimated that around 43% of Africa's total population don't have access to reliable electricity. And joining me now to discuss ways to secure the continent's energy future is NJ Ayuk. He's the executive chairman of the African Energy Chamber. He's in Johannesburg. And Sumeya Mohammed. She is the Uganda country director at Power for All. And she joins us from the Ugandan capital of Kampala. NJ and Sumeya, welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you for having me.
Sumeya, I'm going to ask you to start us off here. Please tell us, how did South Africa get to this point? And how much of the problems that the country is facing is about its reliance on coal? And how much of it is about Eskom, the multi-billion dollar debt, the mismanagement and corruption, and all the other problems we see at the power utility?
Thank you so much, Aida, for having me. I just want to ensure that the viewers know that Power for All is a global campaign focused on ending the energy access agenda. Now, that is an excellent question, and I also just want to, you know, frame it that it's complex. South Africa has, you know, gone through, you know, our own democracy, and I think that, you know, for me, that was ultimately the starting point, because unfortunately, Eskom is a state-owned utility, and with that, there comes in, you know, what is the leadership? What is happening with our Ministry of Energy? What is the direction that the country wants to take? And at the same time, we had to also deal with, you know, trying to bring in equity and diversity, which were historical challenges that wasn't, you know, afforded to many of us, such as ourselves, you know, on this panel today, because we were not, you know, part of the apartheid regime. So having said that, I just want to say that for me, if we even just look at, you know, Eskom's leadership, you can also kind of, you know, see that there's a trend, because there was stability up until, you know, the Brian Dames days, which was from 2010 until 2014. But when he exited Eskom, you could see a very, you know, tumultuous period, and that also coincided with our Zuma period. And that has led, you know, I remember coming back to South Africa in 2008, and just like in the video where we saw the kids, you know, studying under candlelight, I remember doing that because I was completing my honours, and I remember telling myself, we've got to address this energy issue today. However, when, you know, we went through our own reform from 1994, I think the other challenge was we didn't have sufficient knowledge transfer, our integrated energy plan has also been highly neglected, and also we've made some serious policy, you know, I would call them faux pas, just in the sense that we stopped, you know, the renewable energy policy program. And what we've seen in the beginning of this year is that all of a sudden there's an urgency, because solar and wind can be deployed significantly quicker, unlike, you know, what we as South Africans call, you know, the doom and gloom of Medupi and Kusile, which were, you know, the latest addition of coal-fired power plants. That further indicates the skills capacity, because once those plants came online in 2015, we are seeing significant defects and faults, and that speaks to, you know, the competency that is within Eskom. So I think I'm trying to paint a picture that it's a complex situation, but it's directly linked with, you know, our, you know, political situation as well.
NJ, all these different factors at play, economics, it's about mismanagement, there's politics involved as well. What is your take on this? And you travel around the continent and around the world extensively. What's your take on what we see in South Africa? And what would you say are lessons we can learn from this example as people sit in various countries on the continent?
Thank you so much for having me. I think it is a very practical issue that we have to look at. The underinvestment in fossil fuels has been the problem. If you've seen an environment where they've shut down any kind of investment in either fixing coal-fired plants or driving fossil fuels in new production, that is the actual problem. There is not a problem in bringing in renewables and everything, but it's not going to solve the problem. We've seen in South Africa a lot of regulatory bottlenecks, slow regulations and bureaucrats holding things up by not moving the industry. The cleanest form of fossil fuels, for example, gas, you've not been able to really approve gas plants to move or gas projects to go ahead. Look at today, you have Shell not being able to even shoot seismic in South Africa. You have Total Energies with discoveries that all of this gas could be domesticated and fix this problem. They cannot use that. So that is a problem. But we also have to look at the regulation. How have we handled things ourselves? I think we just felt if power was going to be there and we neglected it. It's an issue of neglect. We need to turn it around real quick. It can be turned around, but we need to make those bold steps that would not be politically correct and really get this back again, because this is Africa's most industrialized nation. It is a shame that we find ourselves with load shedding. It doesn't look good for the entire continent, and we have to be very honest about it.
You know, NJ, I want to come back to some of the things that you mentioned here, but I will say, you know, even growing up in South Africa, all the time of my life that I spent there, we did take electricity, for example, for granted. I mean, the lights were always on, the water was always running. I mean, yes, in parts of the country, but we did take it for granted. I want to talk to you, Sameer, about the energy crisis that we see around the world. This is happening against the backdrop of countries around the world looking for gas, for oil, reserves, looking at Africa as well. They're eyeing gas reserves in places like Angola, the DRC, Egypt, Algeria, because of the war in Ukraine that has sent gas prices rocketing. And it is just a mess. And now this scramble that we're seeing for fossil fuels, and let's be fair, that is happening, does it roll back, and how much so does it roll back the fight to move away from fossil fuels to and switch to renewables? How much damage does it do to that fight?
Well, I think it is going to, you know, slow down, you know, renewables, but I think it's also, you know, bringing up this healthy debate that one, innovation, because one of the challenges with renewable energy is that, you know, it's intermittent. You'll need, you know, significant, you know, battery storage to help you to deal with, you know, power 24/7, right? So that you can store that power. And when you need that power at night, when, you know, solar isn't available at night, you can deploy it, right? So there's innovation that needs to happen in that area. I do still, you know, think that the two sectors are going to have to work with one another. And there's room for all of these technologies to be continued and to be progressed. But Haider, you are correct. I do think we are going to see, you know, perhaps a slowdown. But I also call upon, you know, the innovators and, you know, the business sector that, you know, households and businesses are going to need solutions, because as we can see, governments with their decision making and their policies, it's going to take a while to get, you know, those kind of large infrastructural projects up and running.
NJ, I've read you saying that African countries should drop or move away from what you say is the West's green agenda and tap into their vast reserves of fossil fuels. In fact, I've read you saying, drill, baby, drill. Please tell us what you mean by that. You've alluded to some of it earlier, but tell us what your argument is here.
When we say drill, baby, drill, it means we want to use our natural resources to power Africa and develop Africa. I was at COP26 last year, and one of the biggest things we said at COP26 was, let's stop all kind of boilers, let's stop all investments in oil and gas, let's just stop everything. That's fine. Everybody signed these pledges, but then in January, Norway put out 2 oil licenses. Germany started building LNG terminals. The Netherlands opened coal-fired plants, Germany new fired plants, U.S., all federal lands open for drilling, the U.K. first coal power plant in 30 years, and they opened the North Sea up for drilling. Then now you turn to Africa, 600 million people without electricity, 900 million no access to clean cooking, most of them women. You tell them that you don't have the right to use your natural gas, which is the cleanest form of fossil fuels, to do that. Now you have a debate between gas in Africa, for Africa to solve our problems, or coal in Europe, or wanting us to use coal. We don't want to continue using coal. So we need to focus on that. It's very hard to turn to a poor country like Mozambique, who they don't have anything, they rely on aid, and tell them that your future is relying on aid when you could use your really green gas. The EU says gas is green today. You could use your really green gas to power your country and drive yourself. Nigeria, Senegal, Mauritania, and even South Africa. Look at the problems we have in right now. Even if you want to bring gas in South Africa today, you don't even have an LNG receiving terminal to receive that LNG. I think the idea that Africa, the continent with the lowest greenhouse gas emission, outside South Africa, north of Africa, we are 0.05%. When you add the entire continent, 2.73%. That this continent that is the lowest greenhouse gas emitter should be paying reparations to countries that have polluted is wrong. We need to be using our natural gas to really drive up Africa, develop urea, ammonia, NPK fertilizer plants, so we don't have to go back beg Russia and Ukraine to give us fertilizer to power agriculture. Africa spent almost $19 billion every quarter to import fertilizer, and that is a problem. We need to be able to use our natural gas to power Africa, to really get people out of poverty. We need to close the struggle, the gap between struggle and success. But at the same time, bringing in renewables into the play.
I want to get to whether there's room enough for everyone and what the energy mix should look like. But please, NJ and Sumaya, just stay with me. Still ahead here, I want to look at whether African countries should expand their fossil fuel production in order to develop and industrialize, as the world's richest nations have done in the past. Is it fair to expect African countries not to? And let me know what you think. If you're streaming with us online, tweet at us, Straight Talk Africa, or go to our Facebook page and do post your comments there. We'll return right after the break.
Covering the continent every day from east to west, north to south, that's VOA Africa 54. We bring you the latest news and development from Africa. Politics, health, tech, and everything in between. We're on it. Our network of reporters and analysts are on hand to add perspective to all our reports. Join me, Esther Githui-Ewart, Monday through Friday, right here on VOA's Africa 54.
Welcome back. We're discussing Africa's energy future, and my guests are NJ Ayuk from the African Energy Chamber and Sumaya Mohammed from Power for All. NJ, just to pick up on what you spoke about before the break, Samaya, I want to ask you, we saw Sudanese-British billionaire and philanthropist Mo Ibrahim recently criticize countries in the West for what he says is a double standard, because he's saying on the one hand they're warning African countries against developing their gas reserves, their oil reserves, because of climate change concerns, but now they're interested in those very kinds of investments in Africa. Is it fair to expect African countries to move away from large scale development of its mineral resources, digging into their gas and oil reserves, when wealthier nations did exactly that in order to industrialize? Should Africa not have the right to do the same?
Again, that's a great question, and I think it's going to remain, you know, a debate that is topical. I do think that we have to, you know, look at, you know, what is accessible. And I do believe that, you know, the African countries has a right to tap into their mineral resources, but we also need to be sober about the reality that, one, do they have the capacity, you know, to build more efficient, you know, infrastructure to utilize those natural resources? Again, I'm going to look at South Africa, and we look at, you know, the challenges that happened with Medupi and Kusile. So again, Eskom is still building coal fired power stations, but why are they defecting, right? So the point that I want to make is there needs to be a balance. I think that there is a role for both to be playing a role. I also want to just give you the example that we're seeing in Uganda. So in Uganda, we are Power for All. We are working on an integrated energy project, and we're working with the utility called Umeme, helping them to find a balance and working with decentralized renewable energy companies, such as mini grids and productive use of energy companies. Now, what we see is that these two can leverage one another's comparative strengths, right, in order for them to bring faster and cheaper access to people that need power. We also know that how traditional utilities have been deploying power to communities, it's been just, you know, one service, we bring a pole and a wire, and it's up to the customer to figure out, you know, whether they can afford, you know, the cost of wiring, and whether, you know, they can even, you know, afford just getting that connection. But when we see the renewable energy companies and how they've had to, you know, really innovate and really look at, you know, developing that customer, making sure that they're not just, you know, providing electrons, but providing a service, you see a radically different approach, and you see significant, you know, amount of customers that is being developed by, you know, the renewable energy companies. Now, those are lessons that a utility can take away. At the same time, we do need to acknowledge that the mini grids are challenged, right? Because right now they're still being heavily funded by the donors. But when these two come together, they can unlock one another's, you know, comparative strengths in order, you know, for the two to help one another out. Now, I've used that example. So to come back to your point, Ada, we're talking about, you know, the supply side of the issue. Can we tap into, you know, a country's natural resource? It needs to be a healthy balance mixed. And we also need to question, how are those contracts being negotiated? Do we have the skills to execute it? And how are we testing at commissioning that what I've procured is going to be, you know, an efficient system for the price that I've paid? Because in Africa, we see failed projects, and it doesn't come down to, oh, they went and lent money, or they partnered, you know, with certain countries such as the Chinese to bring in, you know, infrastructure. But when you look at that infrastructure being built, you see that it becomes a white elephant, and it just ends up continuing to deepen the wounds across the continent. And I need to speak about those are classic examples. It's not like South Africa isn't, you know, being sober about the fact that
we seem to have some
power. But I also agree with NJ that, you know.
Please continue. Finish your sentence.
Can you still hear me?
Yes, I can. We can hear you.
Yeah, so I also just agree with NJ is that, you know, we haven't looked into gas, we haven't looked into hydro, we haven't even looked into pico hydro. So again, let's look at, you know, what is our resources? Do we have the skills and the competency? And then can we efficiently utilize our resources so that we can have an efficient and cost-effective, you know, service for the power that is needed across the continent.
NJ, at the end of the day, though, there are still the environmental and, of course, the economic effects. If African countries do make greater use of their fossil fuels, they reap the economic, reaping the economic growth, won't we still, though, be paying the price later when we're all standing knee-deep in the impacts of climate change?
No, we would not be paying that price, and here is why. There is more technologies today and technologies of the future that are going to mitigate the climate effect. You're looking at carbon capture technologies. We should be fostering that, and that is going to help us to produce carbon-neutral LNG. That is amazing, to being able to produce carbon-neutral LNG. At the same time, we could be using that gas, for example, to do things like blue hydrogen. And then, like again, I said, you bring in renewables into the game, but we need to be very careful here. We need to know this is not going to meet our real demand. We need to also look at the financing part of it. The majority of financing is not going to Africa. It's going into international companies working in the country. And so there's no local content. How do you build people from bottom up? But it is not an issue where that we have to look at and just say it's going to destroy the environment in the long term. We are doing very good when it comes to it. Nobody loves the environment more than we do. But I'll close with this. If we produce more gas right now, we fix our problems, but also we need to know how to manage those resources right so that we don't go back to the same resource curse of the future. This is a time for us to have some corrective thinking on how that needs to be done. It doesn't affect or negate the message of drill, baby, drill. We need, you cannot produce gas if you don't drill. So we need
NJ,
to drill.
This is, this is a question that, you know, is there the political will, though, to put citizens first when there is money to be made, to funnel that into giving citizens of a country access to electricity? Because my question is, with all our vast resources, with all the technology, yes, there are problems, but there's also, we always talk about potential. Why have we not been able to electrify our people, give them access to the mineral resources so people can benefit? What has been preventing countries from doing that on the African continent?
If I should go first, I would say active citizenry. We have had citizens that have not been able to speak out. Energy has never been a front burner issue to most Africans. They became complacent. We need to be, for me, I want to put energy on the ballot. I want to put energy referendums across Africa. And I want to have energy political action committees to really put politicians on the task to say, what have you done to provide energy access? What have you done to work on drilling for natural gas, but also bringing in green hydrogen, renewable? But on that point, you need to really checkmate and really investigate what's going on with all African power utilities company. Eskom used to be a world-class power utilities company.
Correct.
Today, it's not going anywhere.
Right.
And this is a story across Africa.
NJ, sorry, we're going to have to wrap it there. We unfortunately ran out of time. This is a fascinating conversation, which means we've got to finish this at some other point. But NJ and Sumaya, thank you so much for joining me. Of course, I do think that energy is going to be, in some way or another, on the ballot in the upcoming elections in South Africa. So maybe you'll see some action there. But thank you to both of you. I really appreciate your time and your insights. Great discussion.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that is it for Straight Talk Africa this week. Thank you again to all my guests and everyone who contributed to this week's show, as well as our affiliate stations bringing you Straight Talk Africa throughout the continent. Also, a big thanks to you, our audience, for joining us on television, on radio, and for streaming with us online. Thank you for always watching. Thank you for always listening. Do go well. Goodbye.